Hello, I'm Jeff Watts, and welcome to Optometric Quarterly 88. In this edition of OQ, we have interviews on retinal densitometry, autofluorescence, and measuring visual acuity. In the quarterly review, Jeff Robison looks at papers on subconjunctival hemorrhage, differentiating factors for high-tension primary open-angle glaucoma, and taking scleral IOP measurements with pneumotonometers, amongst others. Visit the Docket website at www.docket.info on your computer, tablet, or smartphone for current and past editions of Optometric Quarterly. You can download OQ as a podcast from the iTunes Store or direct to your iPhone or iPad using the free Docket OQ app from the App Store. And why not send us your feedback on the program by completing our survey using the OQ app or website or emailing inquiries at docket.info. Our first item is on the development of a new retinal densitometer. Macular disease accounts for over half of all visual impairment in the UK, placing a large burden on society as well as on individual sufferers. Tom Margrain from Cardiff University has collaborated with engineers at the UK Astronomy Technology Centre to develop a new technique for detecting the early signs of age-related macular degeneration, AMD. Here, he talks to Gwyneth Morgan about the research.
Tom, perhaps you can begin by reminding us about the developmental stages of age-related macular degeneration.
Well, that's a great question, but I'm not sure anybody really knows the answer to that.
Right.
There's still a lot of debate within the scientific community about what the causes of macular disease are exactly. But I think what is becoming clear is that the retinal pigment epithelium is really at the heart of the problem. I mean, optometrists, of course, are going to be familiar with the early stage of the disease, the changes that we see when we examine the fundus and so on. But the changes in reality start much earlier than that. I think one of the key things to understanding macular disease is to recognise what an absolutely remarkable tissue the retina is. I mean, it has one of the highest metabolic loads of any tissue in the body. Indeed, its demands for nourishment and oxygen are so high that the eye has the choroid, which you can really think of as a wall of blood. And even with that wall of blood present, we know that the outer retina is very nearly hypoxic in the dark. So, you know, it's doing a heck of a lot of work. Naturally, I think as we age, wear and tear starts to build up in those very metabolically active tissues. And a lot of people would really regard macular disease as a kind of extreme form of aging. And oxidative stress, for example, would be one of the main drivers of that aging. In terms of the kind of anatomical things that happen in macular disease, we know there are changes to the choroid. There's a loss of blood vessels, a narrowing of blood vessels. It's not really thought that that's cause of macular disease, but maybe more a result of some of the other things that are going on. One of the most profound changes is at the level of Bruch's membrane, where the tissue gets much thicker due to the buildup of lipids in that layer, and that makes it much more difficult to transport metabolites across the retina and to pump water out of the retina and so on. So changes in Bruch's membrane are likely to be very significant in the development of macular disease. We also know that in the retinal pigment epithelial cells, there's a buildup of a toxic substance known as lipofuscin as well. And as time goes by, we start to see the buildup of drusen between the retinal pigment epithelium and Bruch's membrane. So all of these changes collectively create a gently toxic environment. And after a while, we start to see inflammatory changes taking place, and in particular, activation of the complement pathway. And at that stage, where you have chronic inflammation rumbling on, there are all sorts of other secondary consequences. One of the main ones might be that the retinal pigment epithelium is very able to express VEGF-A in response to complement. So it could be one of the driving forces behind, for example, the development of wet AMD. Now, complement can damage cells directly, but We also know that there are changes in the pigment epithelium with regards to the number of mitochondria. So the number of mitochondria in the retinal pigment epithelium diminishes with time. And so they are unable to deliver the energy needs that are required. And lack of energy production is one of the main triggers for apoptosis as well. So it's thought there are different pathways for wet and dry AMD. Nobody's really sure of exactly how one leads to the other. It's a very complicated solution. So hopefully when you come and see us again in another 5 or 10 years time, I'll be able to give you a more straightforward answer.
I'll hold you to that. What methods are there at the moment available for detecting AMD?
Okay, so the type of macular disease that we're most interested in here is really early macular disease. And I guess the most obvious approach is just by using ophthalmoscopy, looking at the changing clinical appearance of the retina, the build-up and development of drusen and pigmentary disturbance. So really, the ophthalmoscopic examination is at the heart of detection and is really forms the basis of most grading scales that are used in research studies. Now, the OCT has helped us make great advances over the last few years, and the latest devices have algorithms that let us map drusen volume, for example. So there are some more precise ways of monitoring what's happening with drusen. But I think really the most sensitive way of picking up macular disease at the moment is by approaching it from a functional perspective and looking at the process of dark adaptation.
So you've been working on a new type of retinal densitometer. How does that work?
Well, to understand how densitometry works, I found that I had to go right back to my A-level biology days. And when I was taught about visual pigments, they weren't called rhodopsin. It was called visual purple. And it's called visual purple for a very specific reason, and that is that if you look at visual pigment in dim lighting conditions, it actually has a purple colour. Now, when you bombard visual pigments with a lot of photons, there are the conformational changes in the molecule that we know about, and that is reflected actually in a colour change. The peak absorption moves from about, let's say, 500 nanometers down to about 350 nanometers in the UV part of the spectrum. Now, to us, it appears that it's just become clear. So when we expose the eye to very bright light, visual pigment goes from purple to clear. It's a process that we know as bleaching. And our densitometer works by picking up that subtle change in colour of the retina following exposure to bright light.
So what advantages does it have to offer?
I think there are potentially some huge advantages with this technology. Perhaps one of the most significant is that we can measure rod and cone dark adaptation simultaneously. Because we're recording right across the visual spectrum, we're able to differentiate recovery of cone pigments from recovery of rod pigments. So that's great. Another useful advantage is that it's entirely objective. All we need is for patients to sit nice and still for a few minutes, and we can record the data without them pushing any buttons. It's a very fast technique, because when we measure dark adaptation psychophysically, if we're interested in the rods, for example, we have to wait for that early part of the cone recovery before we actually see what the rods are doing at all. Now, with the densitometer, we can literally watch the regeneration of rod visual pigment right from the start. So we can collect all of the data that we need actually within about 5 minutes. So it's fast. Another fantastic advantage is that it's an imaging technology. So we actually get to see the retina on a point-by-point, pixel-by-pixel basis. So we actually end up with topographical maps showing us the rate of dark adaptation right across the retina. So there might be some areas of the retina that are healthy, other areas that are sick, and we can differentiate those very easily.
How was the connection with the UK Astronomy Technology Centre made?
Okay, well, the UK Astronomy Technology Centre is really home to some of the UK's leading engineers. They deal with some of the most expensive pieces of equipment on the planet. They usually build satellites. They build the huge telescopes that we sometimes see on the TV at the tops of mountains on Chile. I mean, when you think about what astronomers really do, they spend lots of time staring out into deep space where there's very little light, where they have to deal with imaging. And really, when we're dealing with densitometry, it's a very similar set of problems. You know, when we're trying to obtain our measurements, one of the key things is we can only put a tiny amount of light into the eye. So although we come from different backgrounds, we found we were talking a very similar language. So that's really how we got to meet.
How did their expertise help your investigations?
I think their sheer technological prowess is something to behold. I don't think that we could have built anything comparable here at Cardiff with our own support. I think some of the key things that they brought was knowledge about detector technology that can let us capture images at extremely low light levels. Also their ability to build fantastic electronic control gear that can coordinate a lot of the camera, light exposure, timing issues and so on, as well as a lot of software development support. So I think it's just their real technical know-how that can address what is apparently a relatively simple problem and solve it, but in a really sophisticated way.
So what's your research found so far?
So far, I've discovered that this is probably one of the most exciting projects that I've ever been involved in. And the reason for that is that this technology, excuse the pun with space here, but lets us boldly go where no man has been before. We can literally see what's happening with the outer retina in a way that nobody has been able to see before. So we are gently making new discoveries, I think, not only about macular disease, but about basic physiology as well. So every day going into the lab actually really fills me with excitement. It's brilliant. We have had all sorts of problems, though. It's not straightforward. Some of the main issues are trying to persuade people to keep really still. Small head and eye movements completely destroy our data sets. Other difficulties that we have are dealing with intraocular light scatter as well. So despite some of these problems, we have conducted a small study on 10 patients with macular disease and 10 healthy controls. And our results from these early studies indicate that the diagnostic performance of this test is actually superior to some of the dark adaptation measures that we've been using so far. So it's an exciting area. We've had promising early results, but we still have some way to go before we can commercialise things, let's say.
That was my next question, really. What are the next stages for the research?
Well, the next stages as well are hugely exciting too, because we have just won a fairly large grant from the National Institute of Health Research to take this technology forward to the next level. Our ultimate goal at the end of this three-year project is to deliver a piece of clinic-ready equipment. So to do that, we are going to use all the knowledge that we have acquired so far on the performance of the system to develop the next machine. And some of the key features in there will be the ability to track head and eye movements to keep our optical system aligned and to automatically quantify intraocular light scatter. So once we've built that next piece of equipment, we're going to be running clinical trials here at Cardiff and also in collaboration with Bristol Eye Hospital. So that's really where we're going to go next.
So you're planning to make the technology commercially available, and you think that might be within 3 years?
I suspect it isn't going to be available within 3 years. You know, within 3 years, we will have built a piece of equipment and we will have obtained the initial clinical data at Bristol and here at Cardiff. It'll be some years after that before I think it goes into production and is available in optometric practice, for example.
Okay, and do you expect it to be used within optometric practice only, or would it be mostly hospital clinics or both?
Okay, so we envisage that there'll be two markets for this equipment. It is very high-tech, sophisticated, and therefore fairly expensive. So I think in the first instance, our main market will be to specialist ophthalmology centres, eye hospitals, and so on. But I think in the same way that the OCT technology started in hospitals and gradually migrated into optometry, the same will happen for this equipment as well. So my hope would be that, you know, within 5-6 years, this would be available commercially for optometrists.
So might the improved detection ability have implications for the treatment of AMD?
I think so. In fact, I think this again is one of potentially the most exciting things, and that is that if we look at current treatments for macular disease, they're pretty barbaric. You know, sticking needles into people's eyes every month is not a good way of treating a disease. It seems so much more sensible to tackle macular disease at an early stage, before there's any visual loss, without having to resort to drastic measures. But as I mentioned earlier, the AREDS study highlights the main problem of developing treatments for early macular disease, and that is that if we stick with ophthalmoscopic grading scales, we need massive sample sizes and very long studies that cost literally tens of millions of dollars. So that's one of the main impediments to developing new therapies for early macular disease. So if this technology is as sensitive as we hope it is to outer retinal function, then this would be a tremendous catalyst to the development of new therapies for early macular disease. So yeah, I'm hoping this is going to have a major impact on how early macular disease is treated in the future.
Well, that'd be fantastic. Does the technology have wider potential applications for detection of other ocular conditions as well?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we've sold this on the basis that it's useful for detecting macular disease at a very early stage, but it's really only looking at outer retinal function. So any conditions that affect outer retinal function are going to have an impact on rod and cone photopigment regeneration rates. So the cone dystrophies, for example, would have an impact. RP would have an impact, and so on. So the main market's macular disease, but I think it has applications across a range of ocular conditions.
I think it's really exciting.
Yeah, so do I.
Thank you, Tom and Gwyneth.